Hello once again and welcome to Musings on Golf, where today we're going to hear great stories of championship golf, both playing and in the fascinating field of golf course architecture. My name is Kelly Elbin, along with my co-host Bob Bupka. Robert, I think our listeners are really going to enjoy hearing from Trip Davis, who was a heck of a collegiate player and has long been one of the most respected golf course architects in our game.
Yeah, Trip was really enjoyable to speak to, and it was fascinating to me that, you know, he was a good player, but he came to the realization, I'm good, but I'm not PGA Tour good. And that is a hard thing to reckon with, and I give him a lot of credit, and the rest of his story is very fascinating, and I know our listeners are going to enjoy Trip Davis on our Musings on Golf show today.
I give him a lot of credit, too. And it is hard, isn't it, Bob? I think when you grow up and you're a really good player and you envision that your name is on a leaderboard on the PGA Tour one day, and when that finally dawns on you that, daggone it, I can't get there, that's tough. But you also have to have that plan B, Bob. You got to be able to move on.
Well, Trip Davis certainly had a great plan B and has designed many a great golf course. And once again, it's going to be fascinating just to listen to the Trip Davis story.
Bob, I know how much family has always meant to you. And the victory by Camila Villegas at the Butterfield Bermuda Championship was certainly about family. It was, in my opinion, the most emotional win on the PGA Tour this season. And it wasn't because he had gone more than 9 years without winning on tour. I can't imagine losing any children. I have two grown kids, and Camilo and his wife, Maria, lost their little 22-month-old baby, Mia, in 2020 to brain cancer. And for him to have dealt with that, to have dealt with the ups and downs, the huge ups and downs of not playing as well, a lot of lows on the PGA Tour, and to have found his way and to have, he was runner-up last week in Mexico, and darned if he didn't come through and win in Bermuda. What a story.
Absolutely incredible. Let's listen to what Camilo had to say about that victory.
Wow, it's unbelievable, to be honest. 9 years. 9 years where you kind of stop believing at times. But I never stopped waking up early and putting the work. Life is interesting. It goes up and down, both on the personal side and on the professional side. But you just got to keep a path, and you got to keep your mind where it needs to be. And like I said, I'm a hard worker. I love working. I love having a purpose every morning. And that's kind of what I did. At the beginning of the year, things were not going great. I was signing up for second day of Q school next week after a tough year. With my play last week, finishing second in Mexico, I didn't have to play second stage, but I was probably going to go play finals. And here we are, a fifth win on tour. So how do you say it? I'm just proud of myself. I'm proud of myself and everybody that supports this team, Villegas.
He should be proud of himself, Kelly. That, you know, as you alluded to, probably one of the most difficult things to face in all of life is to lose one of your children.
Yeah, and I read where Alex Noren, who finished second to Villegas, said that his wife and Camilla's wife are very close, and Noren was so respectful of everything that Villegas has had to overcome and the way he played. I mean, it was a real battle down the stretch and shot for shot. And obviously he had a lot going on in his mind, but he was able to keep that focus on what he needed to do to win. Now gets into the Masters. He gets into major championships next year. He gets tour credentials. Bob, I love this guy. This is a great story, and he is so deserving of everything he's earned.
Yeah, absolutely. A very humble guy. And somebody else accomplished something in their career they hadn't done previously, and that's Max Homer winning an international victory. And Max also a very humble guy, and proud to see him get that victory. I think that's just going to open up the floodgates for even more victories for Max Homer.
Well, he becomes now an international winner. It's the first time he had been in South Africa in winning the Nedbank Golf Challenge. And he really enjoyed his time there. He loved the people. He loved the environment there. And, you know, you get comfort zones, Bob, right, when you're playing. You're certainly horses for courses type of thing. But for him, it's at a larger scale to be able to travel overseas to a place that he's never been and win for the first time there. Yeah, it's a tremendous build to your psyche and your belief that, you know, hey, I can win anywhere and beat anybody.
And somebody else we should mention that you actually have a personal connection to. Tell us that, Mr. Elbin.
Yeah, I've been mentioning my buddy Gordon Long here, who I play with. His son, Adam, he didn't just set the PGA Tour record for most consecutive fairways hit. He smashed it. 69 straight fairways hit based on his performance in the first round of the event in Bermuda, carried over from two previous tour events, 10 better than the prior record that Brian Clarke had held. You know, I don't know about you, but if I hit 10 out of 14 fairways in a given round, I'm elated. 12 out of 14. I'm really happy. 69 in a row. What the heck?
I know. It's an amazing accomplishment. And Adam Long, one of those guys that I think really has a lot of talent. He put it on display. Next season could be a big year for the Long family.
Well, and not only next year, but this is the last week of the PGA Tour Fall Series. I wouldn't be at all surprised if he won this week at the RSM Classic at St. Simon's Island. Much like Vegas, you know, knocked on the door last week and then busted it open this week. Adam, I think he had top 12 or 13. He's been playing well the last few weeks. He should be a factor this week. As we lead into the discussion with Tripp Davis, Tripp has really been a factor. He was a terrific player at the University of Oklahoma. They won a national championship. He's designed golf courses, as you'll hear, in China, done renovations and reworkings of golf courses here, including the Atlanta Athletic Club at Preston Trail in Dallas. And he's got a great Byron Nelson story as well. He's a real all-around golf guy who knows exactly what he's doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And he matches up with the other players that we were talking about because Tripp's very humble and reminds me of a story. The greatest lesson I ever learned in humility took place at a President's Cup, Kelly. I was down on the first tee. There was Gary Player, the captain of the international side, Jack Nicklaus, captain of the U.S. side. There was Tim Fincham, who was the commissioner of the PGA Tour at the time. There was also Bill Clinton on the first tee. So you could tell there were a lot of heavyweights there. And I'm standing alongside of George H.W. Bush. He was right next to me. Quite frankly, I was very nervous standing that close to the president. But all of a sudden, I feel this a little nudge in my ribs. And I look over, and it's President Bush. And he says, "Hey, Bob, isn't this a name dropper's paradise?" I said, "Mr. President, if you think it's a name dropper's paradise, what am I supposed to think it is?"
Great story. That's fantastic. And that's the kind of, that's him. Oh, that's great stuff. You're going to hear some more great stuff from Tripp Davis right after these messages. William & Harry has launched a line of stylish waterproof golf shoes, and they are incredibly comfortable. The WH golf shoe is made of deerskin and suede. It has a gel insert, a form-fitting inner lining, and the reinforced hardened soft spikes on the outside of each shoe provide maximum performance. It's time to elevate your game. It's time to go to WilliamAndHarry.com.
To outperform is to be better. This begins with trusting a golf ball you know will outperform every other. New Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X are designed to deliver longer distance, lower long game spin, more consistent flight, and unrivaled control. Outperform with the new Pro V1 and Pro V1X. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
Welcome back to Musings on Golf. Bob from the highest levels of success on the golf course collegiately. Our guest today continues to achieve great success as a golf course architect professionally. He's the principal and lead golf course architect of Davis and Associates Golf Architecture, and he's a very proud Oklahoma Sooner. Tripp Davis, welcome to Musings on Golf.
Glad to be here.
Hey, Tripp, Bob Pupka here, and we're honored to have you join us on Musings on Golf. And I found it fascinating, doing some research, discovered that actually you wanted to be a professional golfer at one point and explored that, and then came to the conclusion, well, I don't have the physical requirements to be a professional golfer, and switched gears and became a very successful architect. Share with our listeners a little bit about that process.
Well, when I was a junior golfer, you know, that's what I wanted to do. And one of the reasons I came from Atlanta, where I grew up, to go to the University of Oklahoma, because it had a great golf program. My uncle actually had given me the advice of going to a place that had a great athletic program in case there was a coaching change or whatever it may be. So that's one of the reasons I came to Oklahoma. We actually did have a coaching change. And my senior year, I played well and was an All-American that year, and we won a national championship. And so I thought I could play a little bit, and spent right at about a year and a half trying. And I had minor success here and there, but the commercial about those guys being good is true. I mean, I wasn't talented enough tee to green. I had a great short game, and you know, that's kind of how I played good amateur golf. It's something, you know, being a golf course architect, something I really thought a lot about when I was a kid. And there's actually an article when I finished second in the National Junior when I was 15, and the Atlanta Journal did an article about you know, me, and at the bottom of the article, it's really funny. It says, you know, one day he wants to play golf after playing at a school like the University of Texas. Oh. Yeah, I mean, I was 15. I didn't know anything yet.
Right.
But, you know, and then he thinks he also wants to be a golf course architect. So I had to think my way around golf courses because I wasn't as good, you know, physically. And it really led me to thinking a lot about how golf courses are designed, set up, played. You know, I started doing my own yardage books when I was like 11 or 12. And so I thought my way around golf courses better than most. And so that's kind of where it went, you know, from there. I ended up going back to school, also at the University of Oklahoma, to get my master's degree in landscape architecture. And here I am.
And let me ask you this, Tripp. Golf professionals, whether it be club level or the PGA Tour level, they seem very open to trading secrets and practices. You know, a guy will say, well, this works for me. Why don't you try it, Tripp? Is that prevalent with golf course architects? Would you ever have an occasion to have somebody tell you a good idea that was a famous golf architect?
Well, you know, it historically was not only done, it was really commonplace back in the what we called the golden age of golf architecture, where you had, you know, guys like Tillinghast and McKenzie and Maxwell and Ross and Seth Rayner. You know, those guys actually often worked together. You know, McKenzie and Maxwell did a number of projects together, one here in Oklahoma City, the Oklahoma City Golf and Country Club, that we were fortunate to redo a few years ago. And, you know, when I first got into the profession, it it wasn't prevalent. I think a lot of it had to do with how competitive the industry became, you know, because in the golden age, there might have been 15 architects out there plying their trade, you know, and when I got into the business in 94, there were 300 plus. And so it was competitive. And, but I have a recent example of where we were looking for a way to improve the bunker construction at a project that we're doing in Florida. And it's so sandy that we were really concerned about being able to hold the edge on the bunkers. And I thought, you know, I saw that Gil Hans had done some bunkers where he stacked sod on the edges, you know, to form the edge, not a sod stack bunker, you know, like you'd find in Scotland, but just the sod, just the edge itself, just, you know, 4 to 8 inches. And I called him, and he not only spent about an hour on the phone with me, he sent me a detail, you know, and really walked me through it. And, you know, regularly call, you know, would call or email or text and say, how's it going? And so that was great. And I've tried to do the same thing, you know. The one thing that's a little interesting, we don't really cross each other's paths that often. I've tried to do that on a couple of occasions. I think my background, my educational background is, especially going to the master's program at Oklahoma, I had a lot of engineering. And so I'm probably better at drainage than most of my contemporaries. And I definitely have tried to help those guys understand some of that, but I think it's getting more prevalent. It's something we should probably do more of.
Hey, we're so pleased to be joined by golf course architect Tripp Davis here on Musings on Golf. Hey Tripp, I can't be alone among people who play the game who really envy the ability of the golf course architect to take a piece of land and craft it, have the vision and create a golf course out of forest or just dense land. Did that come naturally to you? Did you always sort of have an eye to be able to do that?
I think I've always had the eye for it. I was a little different than some other architects in that when I came out of school, when I was finishing grad school, the state of Oklahoma was getting ready to do 3 state park projects. And I had a friend of mine that's an architect that does commercial buildings and so forth. It's a really good player, a really good golfer. And he had some contacts with the state of, you know, and said, hey, we ought to try to do these projects. And I thought, you know, it'll be a good experience to go through the process of interview, you know, or submitting and all that. I had no clue that we would get either any of them. And one was an 18-hole project and the other two were 9-hole projects. And we got the 2 9-hole projects. And so I thought, well, I'm going to do this, see if I can learn anything, and then I'll go find a job. And we did those 2 projects and, you know, a couple other things came along. And so I never worked for anyone. And so I had to learn what I knew. I had to learn what I didn't know. I had to learn what I did know. And so as I've matured, as I've, you know, gotten into the craft, as I've gotten better at what I do, I've learned that I had a really good eye. I obviously knew the game. And so golf course design really comes down to, you know, being able to make the ground fit how you want the game to play. And so a lot of times any good player can, you know, or really any player can look at something and see that, you know, can fit. And when you've got to move dirt, that changes the ability. You've got to then be able to see how dirt's going to fit once you move it. I think anything you do, you know, you might have a natural ability for it, but you got to have experience. And that's where, you know, you get good at it.
Well, and you were good enough to be called on by a couple of outstanding clubs, Oak Tree in Edmond, Oklahoma, and Preston Trail, where Byron Nelson hung out for years and years, played the Byron Nelson Classic there. Before we went on the air, you were telling us a little bit of a story about getting to know Mr. Nelson. Maybe elaborate a little bit on that and also what it was like to work at 2 really outstanding golf courses as far as updating them, working with the master plan, et cetera.
Well, Preston Trail was a unique opportunity, and I was, we had just been hired to do Northwood in Dallas, and which was a really big coup for us. And then I got a call one day from the general manager at Preston Trail, Kirk Kelly, and he said, we're looking at doing a renovation. We'd like for you to take a look at it. And I was flabbergasted, you know, and worked my tail off to get that project. So once we got the project, we were somewhere in the middle of planning, and one of the guys on the committee said, we ought to go meet with Mr. Nelson. And so they set it up for us to go over to his ranch, and he spent the, you know, the whole afternoon with us. And, you know, I asked him one, you know, I said, how often were you there? And he said, well, they hired me to do a job. So I was there 5 days a week, unless I had some other thing I had to do. I think I think he was doing TV at the time. So every once in a while, and I don't think they did, what did they probably do, 4 or 5 broadcasts a year back then? And so he was there a lot, and he remembered a lot about the 10th fairway was an area that really held water, was really soupy. And that's something we had to deal with when we were doing the project. And we got to talking about him, you know, as a player. And one of the things that astounded me is he went over the back nine of the 35 Masters, which I think is the year he won, shot for shot, you know, clubs, distances. I mean, his memory was amazing. And I said as much. I said, and he goes, well, if you really care about something, you're going to remember it. And that struck with me too.
Hey, Tripp, you just mentioned his memory. My favorite Byron Nelson story, I was down at the Hall of Fame when he was being inducted, and I had played Palmetto right outside of Augusta many a time. And in 1943, I saw the name Byron Nelson, winner of the member guest. Now we're at the Hall of Fame ceremony, and they have every one of Byron Nelson's victory up on this big board. And I said to Byron, I don't see that victory that you got at Palmetto in that 1943 member guest. He said, oh, let me tell you about that. He said, my partner on the 17th hole at par 3, he hit it within a couple of feet, and he made the putt for a net 1. We went on to win. And then at the ceremony, each of us were supposed to get $2,500. And Byron says, you know what? My partner hands me his check over to me and said, you keep it, Byron. I said, wow, he must have had a lot of money. And Byron says, well, he was the president of Bethlehem Steel.
Yeah.
But to Byron to remember, you know, a member guest in all the catalog of victories that he had accumulated, it really amazed me. He was a true gentleman. I've spent a lot of time around a lot of golfers, but probably hard-pressed the finest gentleman that I ever met.
Yeah, he was one of a kind. I didn't get to spend a whole lot of time with him, but you know, I never heard a bad word said about him. And the day that we were with him, you know, he was already in relatively poor health at that point, but was very gracious. And, you know, it was a few months later, he actually called the member and, you know, and asked how we were doing. And so he was very into everything golf and really cared a lot about the game itself.
Tripp, I asked earlier about taking a piece of land and designing it. And then when you drill down as far as designing a golf course so that it fits the needs and the challenges that you want for the better player, as well as making sure the everyday player enjoys it, it's got to be a delicate balance there, isn't it?
It's a tough one. And, you know, you'd asked about Oak Tree. And I think one of the best architects that did that as well as anyone, or probably the best, was Pete Dye. It was in, I think it was in 2006, a friend of mine and his partner bought Oak Tree, the what was called the men's club, or it was called Oak Tree Golf Club, for, you know, most of its early existence. It was an all men's club, and they bought it with the intent of, you know, opening it up a little bit. And then wanted to host major events again. And I said, well, you got to call Pete and see if he's interested. And they brought Pete in, and Pete said, you know, basically, give me the keys. Y'all go on vacation somewhere, and I'll call you when we're done. And they had an X amount of money set aside to do this thing with. You know, these were two businessmen. I knew Pete a little bit at that point, and they called Pete and said, you know, Pete, we really have a budget. And he goes, well, I'm fortunate that I don't have to work with budgets anymore. And so that young man that rode around with us, that I hear he's up and coming, and you ought to have him help you because he knows my golf courses fairly well and playing them. And so we set out to, you know, to make it as, you know, challenging a golf course as possible. But there was still, you know, there was always an eye towards making sure that the average player or the, you know, the person that wants to be a member at Oak Tree can still have fun with it. And you can at Oak Tree. It's very difficult. And so what I learned, not only from being around Pete a little bit, but also from working on this golf course in particular, is the way Pete would separate how a good player looked at a golf course, how they could play the golf course versus how someone not as skilled was margins for error. So if you were going to play one of Pete's golf courses well, you had to hit aggressive shots that had small margins for error. And he would give you all the room in the world to be conservative. Those conservative lines rarely would lead you to, you know, a better player, because better players are trying to shoot around even par. So if they miss a green, they're wanting to get the ball up and down. You know, if you've got a 15 handicap that misses a green, they're trying to get it up and make bogey and move on. And so there's a very different set of parameters that you can, that you'll use and design for those two players. You can make a up and down fairly difficult, but you can make it a fairly easy up and three. And so Pete did a lot of that around greens. His fairways oftentimes would have, you know, lots of room on the wrong side of the hole. You could hit it down the less aggressive line that would leave you a really difficult next shot if you were trying to play that aggressive shot. And so it's two different golf courses that you're looking at. The better player is going to have to take more aggressive lines, going to have to take on the smaller margins for error. And then you can give the average to higher handicap players plenty of room to play to shoot the scores they expect to shoot. And so Pete really understood that well, that, you know, a 15 handicap is going to maybe try to hit five greens in regulation in a round, maybe a few more. And he gave them room to think and miss the places where they could, you know, on average make 15 bogeys and, you know, three or four pars in a round. That's what they're trying to do.
Chip Davis is our special guest here, Kelly, and you touched upon it quite a bit, but I always thought that the ultimate test for any golf architect is going to be able to take a piece of land and make it very challenging for the elite player. But at the same time, with that same land, make it an enjoyable round of golf for the less talented player. Is that really the ultimate goal for architects, to one course that tests the best and allows the rest to have a lot of fun?
It depends on the project a little bit, Bob, because you've got, for instance, we just redid the Riverside course at Atlanta Athletic Club last year. And there's two courses there, the Riverside and the Highlands. And Highlands is where they played most of the major events. They played a women's open on the Riverside course and have had some other, you know, larger events there as well. But sometimes it, you know, it's part what kind of identity the golf course is going to want to have. And I think the difference between the golf courses that are going to be intrinsically more difficult yet still be fun to play comes down to course setup to some extent. If you get the greens firmer and faster, you grow the rough a little bit, you have a set of tees where the more elite player can go back and play it at a longer distance, you know, that gives you the ability to ratchet up that challenge to some extent as well. But the one thing that we have to rely on for the player in order to have fun on those more difficult golf courses, they have to think. And so there's two different types of golf courses that your average to higher handicap player can have fun on. One is there's plenty of room to play, but they have to think their way around it. The other is there's plenty of room to play and they don't have to think so much. And so you have to realize, like, for instance, when you're doing a resort course, and we just redid Gasparilla Inn down on the west coast of Florida, which was a Pete Dye golf course, which was a, you know, there's plenty of room to play, lots of fun. You don't have to be quite as tuned in mentally to, for a 15 handicap to still shoot, you know, low to mid 80s. And, but yet you could set it up to where greens get a little firmer. We use certain hole locations. We put the tees back. It can be a challenge. And so it's partly the ultimate, but it's also partly knowing who your client is and what you're dealing with, because, Oak Tree, for example, if you come out here and you're not going to think, you're just going to hit it, you're going to hit driver on every hole and you're going to try to hit every green. If you're a 15 handicap, you may not finish.
Yeah. Right.
But you can come out here and I can take a 15 handicap and guide them around this golf course and they can shoot their handicap. So Pete, Oak Tree to me is one of the ultimates in that regard. But there's some courses we work on where, yeah, they want it to be a good challenge for the better player and have the ability to set it up similar to Riverside at Atlanta Athletic Club, which is the more member-friendly course there. But hopefully we'll get a chance to do some work on Highlands before the U.S. Amateur in 2030. And that golf course is going to be a little bit more about making sure it is a challenge. And the setup is going to be, we need to have this, the setup to be ratcheted up more. So like when you turn the green speeds up and you turn the rough height up, that increases the challenge maybe more so than it would on Riverside, for example. And so there's a time and a place, but at the same time, you always have to think about how any type of player can get their way around from point A to point B and be able to play the golf course and enjoy it.
Rip, I see that you and your design team are doing some short courses, the 9-hole, the 6-hole. Is that a trend that is likely to continue as people balance their time, wanting to have a golf experience, but not necessarily be an 18-hole golf experience?
There's a lot of that involved. I think there's also a good bit of junior golfers, you know, getting into it. And I think we were seeing that trend kind of before the pandemic. We did one at Willowbrook Country Club in Tyler, great old little golf course there. And they had some room up front and we did 4 holes. And we did that before we started in on the golf course. And we did the golf course 9 holes at a time because there's not a lot of golf around there. And so they wanted to keep the golf course open as we did the work. And every time I would drive in, you know, when the weather was decent, there were kids all over that place on that short course. And this was pre-pandemic. And then since then, it's become a place where you can get out and spend a little bit less time. You can also go out there with your kids. And so I think it serves a number of purposes, you know, one of which is going to be that, you know, the clubs have become pretty crowded and the short courses are given the ability to have access to play some. I know going back to Atlanta Athletic Club, they have a 9-hole par 3. And over the last couple of years, the play on that has gone way up because, you know, can't get on some, you know, on a Saturday, Sunday, you can't get on the other two. And so it's a lottery system even sometimes. So they're, but I also think they're great practice areas. And I like to design them in such a way that we don't build tees, we just build fairways. And so that allows you to, you know, hit shots in to those greens as if you're playing a third shot into a par 5, or, you know, if you're an average player and you're playing your third shot into a longer par 4. I think they're great practice areas and they can double as both.
Hey, Kelly, you ask him about China.
Yeah, I noted that you have an original design in China. What was that like? How do you go about designing a golf course in China?
That was interesting. Have a friend, Bill Hildenbrand, that played at OU and is in the golf business, kind of one of those guys that just puts people together. And, you know, I'd mentioned to him, he came, I think I saw him at OU, he would play golf at OU. And I remember him coming up to me at one of our functions and saying, hey, would you be interested in doing anything overseas? And I said, well, this was, you know, 08, 09, where everything was dead. And so I said, I'd absolutely be interested. And so he and I went over and made a few trips. Ultimately, we were hired to do a new golf course, actually over an old one. We took the old one, just blew it up and started over again because there's a lot of that in China. It's about 2 hours east of Beijing. Really interesting piece of ground along a river. The design process was typical. But when it came time to, getting permits and, having to deal with all that kind of thing, it was more of a pay this guy off. You know, we didn't do any of that. You know, we, the owners, we were actually a Singapore company. You know, they had to, kind of grease some palms and so forth to get it done. And then we were actually getting ready to start construction. And the Chinese government came back and said, oh, this river, we're going to raise the level of it 2 feet. And so we had to change because that 2 feet made a difference in our drainage plan. And so my shaper, I have my own shaper, and he moved over there. I spent a lot of time over there. I think I made 24 trips in about an 18-month period and would stay, if I stayed more than 4 days, I needed to stay a week and a half, because at 4 days, your body switches over and you got to stay. But the project was great. It was a lot of fun. It was really interesting to spend time there, but I may never go back. It's a different world.
Well, you mentioned greasing some palms. With the enjoyment you brought to our listeners, I have a strong feeling we should be greasing your palm. But before we let you go, Tripp, I'm from the end of Long Island, grew up next door to Shinnecock and National. Have you experienced either one of those two tracks?
Oh, yeah. Bill Salinetti is the superintendent at National, who's a good friend. And I don't get up there and see him as often as I would like or I should. But probably for about 10 years in a row, I went up in the fall and would play with him. Shinnecock's a lot harder get. And when Justin Leonard and I were doing Old American in Dallas, it was a golf course kind of based off of Old American classic golf courses. He set up for us to go play a lot of the golf courses on Long Island. We went out to East End, played Maidstone. We played National while we were there, obviously. We went down and saw, played Pine Valley. We went and saw a lot of the other places. And then, I knew we were going to play Shinnecock. He had set that up. And we get up on the first tee, and I look to my left, and there's Ray Floyd. We played with Ray Floyd. Ray had some sort of surgery. So this would have been 2009, maybe. So he was older. I think he was in his late 60s at that point. And we played the golf course, even with Justin. We played it at about 6,600 yards, and he shot 66.
Wow.
But I've had a chance to play it one other time. I tried to take some Australian architects who were in town, and we tried to go over there and walk it one day. And as soon as we got into the parking lot, we were greeted and said, "You're not supposed to be here."
that sums up Shinnecock and National in a heartbeat, believe me. Very difficult to get on, but I still consider Shinnecock maybe as the best U.S. Open test in the country. I know if Shinnecock's not the best, I know Tripp Davis, our guest, has certainly been the best. And on behalf of Kelly Elbin, Bob Bupka saying, Tripp, thanks for taking time out of a very busy schedule and sharing your insight into the fascinating world of golf course architecture. Thanks, Tripp.
You're welcome. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
And tdagolf.net is where you should go to learn more. Just like you, I want to look good and perform at my best on the golf course. And that's exactly why I wear the new WH golf shoes from William & Harry. I love these golf shoes. They're made of deerskin and suede with a soft gel insert, and the reinforced hardened soft spikes increase stability and balance, and they are so incredibly comfortable. I invite you to head on over to williamandharry.com to check out the new WH golf shoe. Look your best and play your best with William and Harry. Bob, I really enjoyed that. I hope our listeners did too. Trip Davis, as you mentioned, humble guy, but he has been involved in some major projects.
Yeah, absolutely. And very talented, as you alluded to, and justifiably so, certainly very talented when he was playing. And I think even probably displaying more talent now that he's a golf architect. And by the way, very, very well respected in the industry. And that's a tough industry to get respect. I can guarantee you that.
No question about it. We thank Trip Davis very much for joining us here on Musings on Golf. Next week, in a special Thanksgiving week, Musings on Golf, Ken Green will be joining us. Ken, former PGA Tour player who went through a terrible tragedy, but has been able to emerge and has continued on in life. And we're looking forward to that discussion we have with Ken Green. My dear friend, Bob Bupka, Kelly Elbin signing off. Musings on Golf.